Hello. In the previous audio snippet, we began to talk about the 10 pillars that will form the basic foundation of the new American Constitution. And we focused on the first five pillars, and we spoke very briefly about each one. And we mentioned that those five pillars define the nature of true authority. And now we'll be talking about the rest of the pillars, the other five. And I believe that in this audio snippet, we'll be talking about the first two if we have time. And we'll continue talking about the other pillars in future snippets. So the next five pillars define the five basic rights of the individual. They're the five fundamental human rights. And as we've said before, there's been a bit of a problem with the way rights have been defined under the current system, under the current constitution. If you go, let's say, to the average American on the street, and you stop him and say, "Hey, can you list to me some of the fundamental rights that you have as an American under the Constitution?" I can assure you that they will start fumbling and stumbling, trying to come up with an answer, an explanation of what rights there are in the Constitution. Our education system in America is so poor that a lot of the people you ask will have no idea about where the rights are listed, shall we say, in the Constitution. You know, because our education system has become so influenced by the left that it is now a shameful remnant of what it used to be. But the few who might be able to give you a bit of a cogent answer might say, "Oh yeah, our rights are defined in the Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights are the first 10 amendments that were added to the Constitution. They were all added basically at the same time. They were drafted and ratified, I think, or drafted in 1788, and by 1789, the following year, they were ratified, so they were exactly 100 years after the Bill of Rights that were ratified in Britain in 1689. So it's interesting that exactly 100 years later we had the Bill of Rights in America, and 1789 is a very fateful year because as many or some of you may be aware, that was the year that the French Revolution started, at least from what I recall. Those 10 amendments were added right after the Constitution was ratified, and they supposedly define our fundamental rights. But it's very difficult to list the rights that are there because they are it's such a laundry list. And we'll have hopefully some audio snippets going through the Bill of Rights, and as we go through them one by one, you will see how poorly written they are. And I'm not saying in terms of grammar and diction, that's not what I'm referring to. It's the quality of the content is so poor. That's what, because basically it's just laundry list after laundry list about specific things. And it's a reflection of a cancer we've had in the American culture almost from its foundation, and we have it to this day, and it's been affecting us. And it's a cancer that I keep referring to without mentioning it by name. It's a word that starts with the letter P, and the more refined version of that word starts with the letter E, and it's something very evil that we've had in the culture, very subtle and very destructive. And it's reflected in how the Bill of Rights is written out. And so if you stop someone on the street, if you're lucky enough to find an educated conservative who, you know, worships the Constitution and all that, and who has some knowledge, and when I say lucky, I mean in terms of at least having an understanding of what you're talking about, they might be able to kind of spit out a few rights off the top of their head. They'll say, oh, the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and they might also mention the Second Amendment right to bear arms, which is kind of like the most popular one amongst conservatives. And then they might even mention the Fifth Amendment, and they might mention it because it's so drilled into our heads by television shows, crime shows, and police shows. The Fifth Amendment, the right to remain silent, and Miranda rights, and Miranda doesn't exist. That term that you hear so much in television doesn't actually exist in the Constitution. It's a term that came up many years later, I think somewhere in the 1960s or 1950s, I forget, or a little bit later, but around that time. So they might know these things, and we'll talk about the Fifth Amendment, right to remain silent as well, and we'll discuss how stupid that right is, and how fundamentally flawed it is, and how much it has caused problems in our legal system and made life so much more difficult than it needed to be because it focused on the wrong thing. But the thing is that people might read off or be able to tell you a certain list of rights, but they would run out of things to say very quickly because even though there are 10 amendments, and each amendment has a whole bunch of stuff, a laundry list stuff in it, at most, even the most educated ones might just tell you 4 or 5 rights. So you would think if there are 10 amendments, there are at least 10 rights, but it's not like that at all. So we need to rewrite the whole thing, and the new American Constitution will have very clearly defined rights, and we have listed them in previous snippets. So, and the concept behind each one is relatively straightforward, clean, and I'd say simple in a qualified way. So, and that's how it should be. If someone says, what are your rights? You should be able to say, I have this right, this right, this right, this right, and this right. Instead of having this convoluted list that the Bill of Rights has, a list that is incomplete, a list that is problematic because it's not related to the truth. And this is an important concept we've been trying to stress over and over again. That we're not trying to make up a system, like say, okay, I we're defining a government and we're just kind of fashioning it like clay to look the way we want it to look. And then once we have fashioned it, we stand, you know, in front of it and go, oh, okay, this is how government should be. No, we are trying to do like a someone who's drawing a portrait of someone else, and that someone else is the true form or the perfect form of government. This concept is out there. It's independent of us. And we're trying to figure out what it is and plaster it in a formal written document. And we're trying to get as close to the actual perfect government as possible. And that's what we're doing here. And I do believe that these 5 rights are metaphysically correct. They are fundamentally right and true, and are the a correct model for defining the rights of the individual. So we'll start with the first right, which is the right to life, that we have mentioned every now and then, and we have emphasized how the current Constitution basically does not say much, if anything, about this right. We've said over and over again that under the current American Constitution, you could be murdered, brutally murdered by someone, and still not have your constitutional rights violated, because murder is not outlawed or banned in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't even protect physical life. So then when conservatives try to use the Constitution to protect fetuses from being killed in abortions, they have very little to go on because the Constitution doesn't even protect the rights of the born. So how can it protect the right of an unborn life? And the concept of the right to life is there, mostly in the First Amendment. But it's given out in this laundry list of things. And the problem is that when you start defining your laws and principles, and especially in a foundational document such as the Constitution, when you start doing the definition of things through laundry lists of specific things, then you're always bound to leave something out or to say something that you're including in the list, but including it in an incomplete way. So there will always be a context where whatever you wrote will not match what you what you wrote will not match what you're living or experiencing in real life, and you'll always have to either add to the list or amend the list, or just live pretending that. You don't have that gaping hole, which is much of what we've done so far. Pretend like the Constitution is complete, and look the other way when there's something that we can't pin down through the Constitution. But so so the right to life is kind of there, but in a very backward way. And what the new American Constitution will do is define the right as a concept clearly, conceptually, and then go into details and provide some examples of the general concept, but the general concept has to be defined. So we've said that the right to life is more than just the right to physically exist and not be murdered. You can be physically alive, but be living a death. Your life can be taken away from you in many ways without you actually being physically murdered. And in essence, the right to life is the same thing, you could say, as the right to freedom. Life and freedom are, in a sense, two sides of the same coin. If you don't have freedom, you don't have a life. And if you don't have a life, you don't have freedom. So if you're living a physical life, but you're being oppressed and being limited, and your freedom is taken away from you, you might as well be dead. So it's important to kind of see those two things from a legal and a metaphysical point of view as two sides of the same coin, like synonyms, life and freedom. And someone might say, well, I know that the Founding Fathers spoke about the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if I'm not mistaken, that phrase, that famous clause or phrase, is in the Declaration of Independence, not in the Constitution. So they were aware, the Founding Fathers, they were aware of this concept of the right to life. It's just a shame that they did not bother to define it within the Constitution. And it's all circumstantial, because of things in history. The Constitution was just a way to replace the Articles of Confederation. It was just a way to kind of loosely bring together these 13 separate sovereign states and hold them together to make it look like a coherent nation. The document was not written from a foundational perspective as to say, okay, this is going to be the foundational document from which all laws in this land will emanate. And because of that, to them it was like, why would we need to define the right to life in the Constitution or protect it there? They just didn't care, because that's not what the Constitution was written for in their eyes. And so it was not a foundational document in their minds. But unfortunately, that it is the foundational document, and since it's a bad foundation, it has led to so many problems through all this time. Subtle problems, and we're seeing the full-blown manifestation of the disaster. And we've said before that liberals are doing the destroying, but they're doing the destroying as a result of all the gaping holes we have tolerated over 200 years within our legal system, starting with the Constitution. So the thing is, the right to life is not defined there. They were aware of the concept of the Founding Fathers, but it's ironic when they say the right to life, and I think this was Jefferson who wrote it, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because liberty and life are really two sides of the same coin. So it really shows that, and you will see as we describe the right to life, how they really are two sides of the same coin. That phrase shows that they really were not, they never really sat down to think about what the right to life is as a concept. And that's why you have the redundancy in a sense when they say life and liberty. And then as we've mentioned before, the pursuit of happiness part was added later. I believe that the original phrasing of the Declaration of Independence, when it was penned by Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, said the right to life, liberty, and property. But I've heard conservatives explain this or say this, and I believe that it's historically correct that they changed it. They asked Jefferson to change it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness because the people who were drafting the document, who were going to ratify the Declaration of Independence and all that, did not want to have property defined so clearly in that declaration for fear that the Southern states would see it as a justification to uphold defend slavery. Because slaves were thought of as property in the South, and by saying that we are fighting for the right to life, liberty, and property, it might sound to the Southerners' ear as if to say, "Oh, we are founded under the concept that I can own my slave, and if my slave is taken away from me, then my rights have been violated." Forget about the slave's rights; my rights as a slave owner are being violated. So I think that as a compromise, you could say Jefferson took that out, even though Jefferson himself was a slave owner, but he took it out and he replaced it with the pursuit of happiness. And every time I think about it, it just sounds so silly and lame. He might as well just have put a smiley face right after that phrase, pursuit of happiness. And life is more than just the pursuit of happiness, and the problem is some people don't fulfill their calling because they are so busy pursuing happiness and not pursuing the fulfillment of what they're supposed to do. So so the thing is, the right to life as a general concept was in the minds of the Founding Fathers. They just never plastered it. And we've said so far, life and freedom have to be seen as two sides of the same coin, almost as synonyms. So now let's think about life. If we think about, literal biological life, how do we distinguish between something that is alive and something that isn't? And this might sound very, very simplistic, but let's say that you're sitting at your desk at work, and suddenly you see your pen start to move. Let's just give that crazy example. Your pen starts to move. The first thing that would happen is you'd be scared to death when you the moment you saw the pen moving on its own. Because why would you be surprised and frightened? Because the pen is not alive. It has no life of its own. It's an inert object, INERT. And as an inert object, you expect it to stay inert, stay motionless. And the moment it starts moving, the first thing that comes to your mind is, oh my goodness, it's alive. The pen is alive. So we can see from that just theoretical example that life is associated to the concept of movement. If something can move on its own, it's alive. And somebody might say, oh, well, a tree is alive, and I've never seen a tree walking around. Yes, you're right. But even though a tree is stuck in the same place and it's not moving from where, it was originally planted, unless somebody moves it, the tree is moving. Maybe not to a different location, but the roots are moving. The roots grow and stretch out to get as much coverage as possible to get all the nutrients it needs from the soil, and the tree starts growing up. It maybe not be relocating, but it's moving up, and the branches branch out and the leaves come out. So there's movement in the tree, even though the tree is in the same place. There is movement. So wherever there's life, there is autonomous or independent movement. So we can see that the right to life, the first principle behind the right to life is the freedom of movement. And so the New American Constitution will state that, in a very clear way. The right to life involves the freedom of movement. And that means that any law that limits your movement in an unnecessary or very restrictive oppressive way is violating your right to life. If you're in a place where your right to life is respected, you will have freedom of movement, relative freedom of movement. And any law that starts restricting that freedom of movement is infringing on your right to life. And we've said mentioned before that under the New American Constitution, every law that is written will have to be every law that is passed will have at the end of it an explanation saying this law is upholding this right in the Constitution, or it is restricting this right in the Constitution, and give a proper explanation, a very clear and justifiable explanation for why it's attempting to restrict a certain right in the Constitution. And then that law can be challenged on that explanation. That explanation has to be clear. It has to be beyond reasonable doubt. And if it can be proved legally that someone can challenge the law and say, hey, I can prove that that explanation is not valid, or that it's not beyond reasonable doubt, then the law can be automatically stricken down as unconstitutional and be void, be null and void. That's how it will work in the new system. So, for example, right now, at the time of this recording, with all the limitations that keep trying to impose on people moving because of this over-exaggerated virus thing, this pandemic, they are passing or imposing these mandates, these laws to restrict movement, but they are based on just the thought, oh yeah, we have to stop the spread, and 2 weeks to stop the spread, and we've been in these 2 weeks for going on 2 years, and it never stops because there's no way of fighting the law based on the condition that's there's no condition in the law saying, okay, we are restricting the freedom of movement because the scientific data shows this, that, and the other. And we can't challenge it because the system, the way it's framed, does not allow for that. But in the new system, if somebody ever dared to do the sort of thing they're doing right now, they'd have to be provide very clear justification with the scientific data saying, okay, the virus is spreading this way, and we've seen studies that to restrict it, we have to do this, that, and the other. And then if someone comes and shows, hey, the data does not match the reality, you're giving us false data, or that data is outdated, or that data was not properly vetted, or whatever, and you can prove, hey, look at Sweden and Denmark. They didn't have all these restrictions on the freedom of movement, and they don't have the spread of the virus compared to Israel or Peru or all these other countries where they were drastic and vicious in the imposition of restrictions on the freedom of movement, and the virus number of cases is much worse than in other countries like Sweden and Denmark and other places. So the thing is, if the freedom of movement is being restricted, your right to life is being restricted. And if a law tries to do that, then it has to provide very clear justification beyond reasonable doubt. And if it's just a hint, somebody has this idea that, oh, I think the virus will spread if we do this, and therefore we're passing this law, that is not enough. It can't be based on a hunch. It has, if there's a hunch, and maybe the hunch is valid, then the most that legislators can do is provide guidelines, public suggestions to people. Oh, we don't have the proof, we don't have the scientific data yet, but we believe that the virus will spread if you get within 71 inches of somebody else. You know, at 72, you are protecting the other person, but when you move that one extra inch and you're within 71 inches, and you're 1.99 meters of the other person, then the virus will jump from you and hit the other person, and the other person will get sick. If they really believe that, which has been established to be nonsense, and that's for another audio snippet if there ever will be one. The thing is that's just a bunch of superstitious hokum. That's all it is. The scientific data does not support that. It's never supported that. So, but if they really believe that, they're convinced. They are not. You know, this is all just excuses to do other things. But if some of them are sincerely convinced that this is a scientific reality, if they can't prove it scientifically, and they have a hunch, then they can. The best they should be able to do under the new American Constitution would be to recommend to people, please stay 72 inches away from people. We cannot impose it on you, but we are recommending it strongly for your own protection. Blah 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 blah. It's important. Principle number one under the right to life is the freedom of movement, because life has movement, all autonomous, independent movement. So if you restrict movement, you're restricting life, and you're restricting freedom. So, okay, that's principle number one. Now, a second observation that we can see from literal biological life is that things that are alive have this tendency to grow. That's another characteristic you could say of life. So principle number two, the right to life also entails the freedom to grow, and that, you know, not only means the freedom to grow physically, but grow in other ways, emotionally or in terms of prosperity, etc., etc. So any law that fosters an environment of growth is a law that's upholding the right to life, and any law that fosters an environment that stunts growth is a law that is violating the right to life, and this sounds like a very general esoteric concept, but it has very practical applications. If you have, you know, the war on poverty that we've had in America since the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson stupidly started that. Lyndon Johnson was just a disaster. And we are living a lot of consequences from a lot of the stupidity he did, even to this day. So the thing is, Lyndon Johnson started the war on poverty, and he, and the basic idea was, we're going to just dump a whole bunch of money into poor communities to get them out of poverty. Just dump money into it, and these useless programs just to somehow fight poverty and end poverty in America. And what that those policies have done, we've seen over the years, if you analyze what they have done, is to actually increase poverty. They have actually made poverty a permanent state of living in many minority neighborhoods. If you go to black neighborhoods, a lot of them are just gripped with crime and drugs and hopelessness. I mean, it's almost mind-numbing when I think about it. If I had grown up as a black kid in a black ghetto, in a black neighborhood, how my perspective on life would be so different and so full of hopelessness and sadness, just knowing every day, you know, that somebody got gunned down the other day across the street or whatever, or my friend got killed or whatever, and to go to a public school where the unions, the Democrat unions are running things, so they have all these inept teachers that can never be fired, no matter how bad and inept they are. And I go through the high school public school system, and I graduate without the ability to read and write, even the basic skills that you would expect from a secondary school graduate to have, you know, like reading and writing, not having those skills, and then having to work in dead-end jobs. And there's no growth, there's no hope of prosperity and growing. That, and those are the laws that come, those are the consequences of the war on poverty, because they, and that's a story for another audience, but to explain that in detail, but in short, it's just the problem has been pumping money into the system to create a permanent state of dependence on government, while not addressing the core cultural issues that are bringing restriction to life in those neighborhoods. So the money's just coming in, and then it's being used just to use drugs and get into crime. It's just becomes the funding source for a lot of crime activity and for drug abuse and for idleness and all these things. And it just, it's a vicious cycle of hopelessness. And so there's no atmosphere of growth. So we could, under the new system, we could then grab these laws that are creating this environment and say, okay, these are violating the right to life of Black Americans. And we have, because of that, these laws are unconstitutional, and we have to rewrite them. So everything would be, it's like a lens that we can apply to a law and see, okay, is it creating an environment of growth, of prosperity for people? And if it isn't, then, oh, it's stunting the right to life, and we'd have to deal with it and change those laws as needed. So so there's freedom of movement, and then freedom to grow. Those are two principles under the right to life. Then, if we observe biological life, we can see that living things have this tendency to reproduce. Inert things can't do that. You can't, like, leave a pen or a couple of pens on your desk one night at work and then come back the next day and now there are three pens, like one extra pen, like a baby pen born. Out of the two pens that you left the night before. Things like that don't happen with inert things, but living things reproduce themselves. So you have a couple of rabbits, then given enough amount of time, you'll start having like 5, 6, 7 rabbits, and then 10 and 100 and so forth. So the right to life involves the freedom to reproduce. And that this is not just about freedom to reproduce biologically, and please don't misunderstand the word reproduce here, because the word the phrase reproduction rights has been taken by the left to justify abortion and all these other things, but that's those are not reproduction rights that they're talking about. It's rights to not reproduce. They want to have the right to abort a fetus and any possibility of reproduction. So it's not reproduction rights; it's rights to not reproduce. If you want to phrase it that way, so please don't misunderstand. This is, we're not talking about the freedom to end reproduction. That's actually the opposite of the right to life. It's the freedom to actually reproduce. And this, as we said, it's more than just the freedom to reproduce and have babies biologically. It's more than that. It's the freedom to produce more people like yourself. Like when a father has a son, the son is kind of like when he has children, he is reproducing himself in a way, you know, biologically in multiple people. And obviously, kids tend to look like their parents. So you're producing people who look like yourself. And if you project that in a more generic sense, then the freedom to reproduce is the ability to do things that produce people who start to think and act like you. Therefore, we can say that that this ties in with the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion. Because when you have freedom of speech, what you're doing is you're expressing ideas, you're expressing thoughts, and obviously you're expressing these thoughts with the intention of someone hearing what you're saying and believing you and agreeing with you and starting to think like you. So the freedom of speech is a way of you trying to reproduce yourself in other people and to have other people think like you. And the reason why the freedom of speech is such a dangerous thing in communist countries, in dictatorships in general, is because the freedom of speech has the danger of turning a whole bunch of people against whatever the totalitarian bastard is declaring. That's why the totalitarians are so afraid of freedom of speech. That's why the bastard Xi, doesn't like the people tortured by him to think on their own, to say things freely, because he's afraid. You know, Xi is a coward, a bastard, pathetic little coward. He's afraid. He pretends to be this bully, but he's just a pathetic little coward who is afraid of the people, and he's afraid of people beginning to think differently from whatever the hell he's thinking. So because if let's say you listen to a crazy man standing in the corner of some street, and he starts shouting a whole bunch of stuff, and everybody walks by him, and they know he's he's crazy, and they will just walk past him and ignore him. And a dictator will not be afraid of a crazy man like that saying those things, even if it's things that he doesn't like, because he knows nobody's going to pay attention to him. Everybody knows he's crazy, so whatever he says will be ignored by everybody else. So the freedom, they are not afraid of words being spoken necessarily just because they disagree with the words. Sometimes they are, but generally the words are not a problem. Their fear is that those words are going to fall like seeds in someone's brain, someone's heart, and they're going to germinate and produce more people who think like that, and that becomes a danger to them. So this freedom to reproduce is tied to the freedom of speech in that sense, and that's why the freedom of speech is so important and it's so dangerous in the eyes of tyrants. And freedom of religion is the same thing. When you're practicing a religion or a faith, you're basically kind of teaching other people, this is the way life is, this is the way you should act, this is the way you should do things. That's why communists hate religion so much, because religion is providing an alternative way of seeing the world that is not exactly within the framework of Marx and communism, or Mao, or whatever bastard they're following. It's dangerous. Religion fosters the reproduction of people who think in a certain different way, and that's why they have to stop it and quell it. So that's the third concept, freedom to reproduce. So anything that tries to prevent your freedom to have yourself produce more people like you, that is infringing on your right to life. And any law that tries to do that, then automatically will know, hey, my right to life is, our rights to life are being violated by this law, because they are preventing my right as a living thing, a living being, my right to produce more people who look like me. And when I say look like me, I mean, you know, who think like me, who act like me, or who believe what I believe. So that's the third thing, the freedom to reproduce. Now, the fourth thing that we want to talk about is a little more complex, but I hope it makes sense. We'll try to go through it quickly here. If you go to a dictionary and try to look up a definition of freedom or liberty, because we've said right to life is the right to be free, because life and freedom are two sides of the same coin. So, so if we want to understand life, we can also do it by going from it, going from the side of freedom. We've been going up from the side of life. Now let's go from the side of freedom a little bit. If you look for a definition of freedom in dictionaries, it's very varied, because freedom is a very difficult concept to encapsulate in a definition. But if you try to look in definitions, a lot of them have this word control in it. Like freedom is when you're not being controlled by a government or a foreign power or so forth. So there's a clear correlation between freedom and the lack of control, of being controlled. So control in a sense is the opposite of freedom. So if you start thinking about that, then let's now go back to life. We thought about freedom. Freedom is associated to control, or is the opposite of being controlled. Now, if we think of life, a lifeless thing is let's think of a lifeless thing. Let's say a car. A car does not have a life of its own. And when you when people commute to work, they get in their car. If they don't use public transport, they get in their car and they turn on the engine, and then they start turning the steering wheel and pressing the accelerator and all that, and they start moving the car, directing it until they get to their workplace, their destination. So in all that time, they are manipulating or controlling the car. They're telling it when to start. They're telling you when to go, they're telling you when to stop, they're telling you when to turn left, when to turn right. They're totally controlling and manipulating the car. It's a lifeless thing that you manipulate to get to your destination. And from that we can see that that lifeless things are manipulated or controlled to achieve an end. And you don't feel bad about it. When you get to your workplace and you get out of your car, you don't go, oh, I feel so bad because I just used this car. This car, it's like I didn't care what it thought. I didn't care where it wanted to go. And I made it, come here. And you don't feel bad for that, because it's just a thing. It's a lifeless thing that you use to achieve an end. Now, let's think about another living thing, another non-living thing. Let's say a hammer. When you have a nail and you have a hammer, you take the hammer and you hit the nail with the hammer, with the hammerhead, and you go bang, 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 bang until the nail is all the way into the wood, let's say. When you're finished hammering the nail, you don't feel bad about the hammer. You don't say, oh, I hope the hammer didn't get a headache, from all the banging that I did with it. And I hope I didn't hurt the hammer's feelings or anything like that. It's just a thing, a lifeless thing that you're manipulating, controlling to achieve an end, which is to drive that nail into the wood. But let's say that instead of a hammer, let's say you didn't have a hammer around and you really wanted to drive that nail into the wood and it had to be done now for some reason. And you had a pet turtle, walking around, and you look around, and you see the pet turtle moving, walking around. You go, oh, okay, I can use that. And you grab the pet turtle, and then you say, oh, the shell is kind of hard. So you grab the turtle and start using the shell to hit the nail with the shell and pound the nail until it's driven into the wood. And then you release the turtle and let it go about its business. Now, if you think of that gruesome example, you go, oh my goodness, that's evil, because you don't care about the turtle. The shell, might be hard, but it can only take so much pounding, and you might have done permanent damage to the shell. And every time you pound the little turtle against the nail, you're hurting that little thing, even though it has a shell, but it feels the impact of the crash into the nail every time. So you don't know what state you left that poor little turtle in. And you would say, oh, that's evil. Somebody doing that is evil, because what happened there? That person had no regard for the life in that turtle. It just used it. It just wanted to drive a nail into the wood, and it didn't care about the consequences to that living thing, and it just used it for that purpose and then released it to say, okay, I'm done with you. Go about your business. Go eat your lettuce or whatever you eat. So that means that in that kind of gruesome, horrible example, you can see another principle related to the right to life, and it's that the right to life involves not seeing people as means to an end. And that's and you may say, oh, that, you know, why do I care about that? That's a very important principle that has to be plastered in the new American Constitution because it deals with the issue of collectivism. In a communist society, people start losing their individual identity, and they just become like dispensable cogs in this machine. So, you know, because there's no individuality, they're all the same thing. They're just means to an end. So you need a person, you know, to build a pyramid. You just plug this person into the project to build the pyramid. And if he dies building the pyramid, that's okay. If he dies, then we'll just go get someone else to replace him. And because we want to build the pyramid. And so you take all this labor and use it, and if they die, that's fine. We just replace them because the individuality has been erased, and everybody's just a means to an end. If you look, for example, in China, I think it was in the 1960s when that little bastard boy Mao, who is now burning in hell as we speak, and I'm just rejoiced just thinking about it, just hearing his screams of torture. He's being tortured forever and ever. And he's screaming right now. He's being tortured. He's burning like hell, literally. This bastard, when he was around on Earth, he did some of the most brutal things in human history. And I'm always angered at how Nixon and other people gave this bastard boy credibility that he never should have had. That's like giving Hitler credibility or Stalin credibility. He committed great atrocities. And one of the many atrocities that he committed was, what some people call the Cultural Revolution that he did. And I don't remember the details, but he wanted to reorganize Chinese society in some way. And I don't remember if it was like he wanted to turn it into a more rural society or into a more urban society or a combination of both. But I really don't care about the details because it was just an evil institution that he established there. But in his Cultural Revolution, in this master plan that he had for Chinese society, he uprooted millions. I mean, I'm not just saying that it's an exaggeration. He uprooted millions of Chinese people from their homes and drove them to these collective places where they would do planting and all that stuff. And a lot of people suffered through all that relocation, and millions of people were slaughtered and died, and people who opposed any of the thing that he was doing at that time were being tortured and killed. And millions of Chinese people died because he had a plan. He had this master plan, and to him, the Chinese people were just, because there were so many of them, that to him, they were just like rabbits, all these rabbits, what's with losing a couple of million rabbits here when there are all these hundreds of millions of rabbits still available to be used? So he just used people, and they were means to an end. He didn't care what those people's dreams were, what their intentions were in their own personal lives, because there was no individuality. There was just this collective. They're all these mindless people serving the collective purpose. And he did all this worthless destruction that he was never really confronted about while living, but he's now feeling it in hell as we speak. And I'm mentioning this as an example of why we need to plaster this in the Constitution, that anything that doesn't see people as individuals and sees them as more or less means to achieve an end with no regard for their individual dreams or purposes or whatever, that is violating the right to life. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why it was so important to the bastard liberals in America and in other places to have people wearing their face nappies, those face diapers, those masks, because the mask was a way to hide your face, to hide your individuality. And then you just look around and everybody's wearing a mask. It's like everybody becomes this robot, this cog, all these individual cogs in this machinery. And it's all means to an end. The state is fighting the virus, and because of that, we're implementing this plan where everybody has to do this. They have to stay 2 meters in Europe and 72 inches in the United States away from each other. And you, when you stand in line, you have to stand at these exact positions, and you have to do this. It was a way of training people in the ways of collectivism, where you and anybody who was different, who wasn't wearing the nappy, who was opposed to this thing because there's no scientific foundation for it, there's still no scientific justification for it. Anybody who swerved from the collective thinking was immediately ostracized and criticized and attacked and destroyed. And that's part of the reason why they use the term social distancing. Because it was a way of introducing socialism in a subject in a very surreptitious way. Your focus is on the collective, on the goals and the means of the collective. You lose your individuality. You don't care about yourself. You don't want to be selfish and just think about yourself. And that's why they kept using the word selfish. And even with the people who are not taking the rape by injection, the so-called vaccine, oh, you're being selfish. It's this thing that, no, you have to lose your individuality. We have to force you to lose your individuality to just think about the collective. And you're the Borg in the Star Trek series. You lose your individuality, you become part of the collective, and you become a means to an end. And that's how they kill your right to life. And the Constitution, that has to be plastered, that any law that starts treating people as means to an end, we are going to stop all economic activity because our goal is to do this with the virus, and their goal was really to steal the election, but our goal, purported goal, is to do this, and we don't care if we destroy the economies, if we destroy lives, we just want to get rid of Trump, so we're going to paralyze everything so that we can then have a justification for controlling people's lives and doing mail-in balloting and this and that and the other. So they had these plans, and they didn't care about how people would die, how they would destroy economies, how people would suffer, and a lot of people committing suicide, all these things that began to happen when they started doing all these things, because there was just means to an end. They just see people, the greater goal of reaching this nirvana, this magical communist nirvana that they have in their minds. This is socialistic nirvana, where the collective, there's this central mind that's defining what's best for everybody, and no one is thinking about themselves. Everybody's just thinking about the collective, and everybody's just clones of semi-living beings that are just working to produce the collective's goal. And any law that tries to promote that should be immediately labeled as unconstitutional. And we need to have these legal weapons within the Constitution to be able to fight any attempt at destroying the right to life. It has to be plastered in the document. That's why all these things that are being done, and there's so little power, argumentative power to fight them, because the Constitution does not give us the weaponry to do it. So that's number four. So we've seen the right to life involves the freedom of movement. Number two, the freedom to grow. Number three, the freedom to reproduce. Number four, it involves not seeing people as a means to an end. And now, and this thing that we've talked about, not seeing people as means to an end, not seeing them as controllable inert entities, also brings up the fifth point. And the fifth point has to do with individuality and difference. Because when you start controlling people, they become indistinguishable from each other. And the right to life involves recognizing individuality and the right to be different. And now the right to be different, you can see, for example, sometimes I like to observe dogs. I'm a big fan of dogs, and sometimes I watch them when people are walking them. And I observe them, and I go, each one of them has like their own personality. You can see it. You know, some of them are kind of like very nice and submissive and obedient, and some of them are rambunctious and like out of control, and some of them are playful. Some of them are, you know, very sweet and adorable, and some of them look nasty, like they're gonna bite you if you get too close. And every dog has their own personality, and the same thing with human beings, the same thing with all sorts of animals. Even with trees, you can see, you know, they might be the same species, but two trees side by side, one looks, one has a certain look, and the other one, has his branches looking a little differently. Every tree is unique. So life involves the proliferation of individuality and differences. Living things, because they're free, have the freedom to be different from each other, because they're not just all following the exact same path. That's the fifth concept. The right to life involves the recognition of individuality and differences. As we said, trees in a forest, every tree is different. Even though it's one big forest and they might be all the same species, every tree is different. I'm not sure if I've ever heard anyone explicitly condemning individuality, but at least from the left. But it seems to be the sort of thing that just rubs them the wrong way. If you're in front of a liberal and you want to really irritate them, just start talking about individuality. They just hate it. Oh, you cannot believe how much they hate the word individuality. They hate it. They abhor it. And that's why if you really want to irritate them, you know, and get them to get away from you, just start talking about individuality. You'll just irritate them so much that they'll just walk away. And the problem is they can't really argue with you openly about it, because they don't want to kind of expose themselves for what they are, that they are the killers of individuality, and that they just want robots. But they hate individuality because individuality means independent thinking. It means you not just thinking about the collective and surrendering yourself to this master plan. So individuality and difference have to be kind of highlighted in the Constitution, so that whenever a law is passed that starts to suppress individuality, that starts to suppress people's right to be different from each other, to have different personalities, etc. Whenever any law suppresses that, then automatically we can detect, okay, it's violating or infringing upon the right to life. And we have to see whether or not that infringement is justifiable or not. So now, just as a side note, it's important to mention that this thing about collectivism that we've been talking about kind of bears out why things such as eminent domain are such a bad idea. And that's a principle in the Constitution. I forget exactly where it is in the Constitution, but if I'm not mistaken, there's some clause that talks about eminent domain, and that means that the founding fathers reserved the right for the government to take property away from you if it's deemed to be for the common good. Like, for example, they need to build a highway through your property, and there's no other way to build it unless they do it through your property, and they just come and tell you, hey, we're buying your property from you, or confiscating it, taking it, and we're going to build the highway. And I think they're supposed to give you a reasonable compensation for it, but you have no choice over it. If the government wants to take that land, they will take it, and you'll just have to move. And I've always found that an abhorrent thing. How in the world can that be? Well, but that's part of the concept. So there's collectivism already embedded in the founding fathers' constitution. You know, this document of freedom that conservatives are so proud of has this embedded, this very sinister concept of collectivism, where no, the greater good, the common good, is much more important than your individual right, and we can at any moment suppress it. And the problem is, this becomes a carte blanche for anyone, because, you know, who defines what the greater good is? Because it's not in the Constitution. It just says, okay, I forget if it's that's the exact wording, but you know, but in general, it basically says, if it's for the common good, the greater good, then yes, you can confiscate this person's property. But, you know, they didn't bother to define what the greater good is. So anyone can just say, you know, the greater good is this, and they just make up some nonsense, and they can take away your property. And that is sinister. And that's why it should never have been written into the Constitution. And you go, okay, well, but what if we can't build a highway? Well, if we can't build a highway, we can't build a highway. That's just the way it is. And we'll just have to build around the person's property. It's his property or her property. What are you going to do about it? That's just the way it is. And the principle of respecting that person's rights are more important than how much it will cost to go around his property to build that freeway. It's as simple as that. And we wanted to talk about the rights of animals, because that is part of the Constitution. And you might say, oh, that's crazy, the Constitution having the rights of animals there. Yes, it needs it, and we'll explain why. Strange as it sounds, and it's not because I'm some sort of nut job conservationist or whatever, fighting for the polar bears that are dying because of... you know, the world temperature is rising, and they're just floating on these little ice patches, and they have no hope. No, I'm not of that crowd. Believe you me. But the rights of animals have to be plastered in the Constitution, and you will see why it's so important, because it also is a benefit to us humans to have those things clearly laid out. You will see, and it has to do with so many things, including abortion and all this stuff. I think we've run out of time. I really thought we were going to get through this very quickly and get to the second right, the right to privacy, but we won't be able to do it this time. So we'll talk about the rights of animals and how it relates to the right to life, the right to life of animals. It has to be clearly defined in the Constitution. Then we'll move on and talk about the right to privacy. Which will be the second right of the individual, and the seventh pillar of the new American Constitution. That will be next time. Thank you very much.